You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do you really need 10,000 steps a day? We'll talk about exercise and how to figure out how much we really need. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about collecting stories for future generations.
UW Oshkosh has completed a massive oral history project documenting the campus's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. As WPR's Joe Schultz reports, it could serve as a resource to help future historians understand the pandemic's impact on higher education in the United States.
People filter into an auditorium at UW Oshkosh. They talk with one another as audio from campus community members begins to play in the background. Suddenly, the auditorium goes silent as lecturer Grace Lim takes the stage. She poses a question to the audience about the pandemic.
Why, after 3 years, would we want to revisit those really terrible, dark days?
Her answer?
Telling the story of our collective trauma, our loss, and our resilience is the goal of the campus COVID stories.
Lim has shared thousands of stories from the community for nearly a decade through the Humans of Oshkosh Facebook page and books. But as the pandemic started to drift into the rearview, a new storytelling project emerged. Campus COVID Stories would document how UW Oshkosh responded to the pandemic.
It took me a while to understand how important this is, not only for the future generations and the historians, but I think it was necessary, it was critical that we tell our stories. We need to acknowledge that we all went through a trauma.
UW Oshkosh's pandemic tale mirrors other schools in the UW system. It went virtual in spring 2020, returned to a hybrid model in the fall, and gradually worked its way out of precautions as vaccines became available. The campus COVID stories provide what Lim describes as the most complete account of a campus response in the system. Over 3 semesters, Lim and her students collected over 1.5 million words from administrators, faculty, staff, and students.
I believe these are the stories that connect us as a community.
The project also showcases the plight of UWO's essential workers. That includes lecturer Heidi Hansen's students in the College of Nursing. Many worked as CNAs at nursing homes and hospitals in the midst of a global pandemic.
These are 19, 20-year-old kids who are alone in a long-term care facility with multiple COVID patients and people dying more rapidly than they've ever experienced or may ever experience.
But she has shared this wisdom with her students.
Your grandkids are going to ask you what you did during the pandemic, and you will be able to share with them that you helped prevent disease transmission and you saved lives.
The project also preserved Jada Berg's experience. When she was a UW Oshkosh nursing student, the tragedy of the pandemic hit especially close to home. In late 2021, her mother was hospitalized with COVID-19, shortly before she was scheduled to receive a vaccine. After that Christmas, Berg was visiting her mother in the hospital when an alarm sounded.
I can read EKGs because of my nursing school, and she was an ST elevation, so she was having a cardiac crisis. And they do the code, the doctor comes up to me, and she gives me this look that I've seen from a ton of doctors and a ton of nurses. It's the, we can't do anything else, like, this is it.
Berg's mother died from COVID-19 complications.
It's really hard watching people still deny COVID when I watched my mom honestly die a pretty bad death because of this. She was 45 years old. Like, I lost my best friend, my absolute rock of my life.
Berg didn't let that tragedy stop her from achieving her goals. She graduated in May 2022 and now is a registered nurse at UW Health in Madison. In many ways, her story showcases the resiliency of the UW Oshkosh community, highlighted by the pandemic. And countless other campus COVID stories also display that ability to bounce back in the face of adversity.
WPR's Joe Schultz brought us that feature on UW Oshkosh's Campus COVID Stories. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Instagram, and through our podcast feed. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, obsessive step counters, listen up. If you've been striving for 10,000 steps a day, like me, turns out we might not actually need that many steps to get the health benefits. even if you might need to get 10,000 to win the daily competition you've got going with your coworkers or spouse or whoever. As Scientific American reports, that 10,000 steps a day number, it actually comes from a marketing gimmick. When a Japanese company came out with an early pedometer in the 1960s, they went with 10,000 because the Japanese character for that number looks a little bit like a person walking. In reality, depending on your age and other health factors, your mileage may vary. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you count your steps with a pedometer or a fitness app? Do you get competitive about it? Do you try to keep a streak going? Do you like going for walks, for exercise, for fun, whether or not those steps actually get counted? What motivates you to do something regularly for fitness? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Shayna Schertz is a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System. Shayna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now I aim for that 10,000. I know there's nothing magical about 10,000. When you're talking to someone who asks you this question, or maybe someone who comes into Gunderson, what do you tell them about, you know, how many steps people might actually want to get if they're using walking as a main form of fitness?
That's a great question. So typically I would have someone see what they are averaging a day or a week. So take your step count over the course of a week, divide that by 7 and see how many you're averaging per day. Then you would want to, if you want to up that, you want to probably increase that by about 20%. So if you are, say, getting, let's say, 5,000 steps per day, then you just want to take that number, times it by 20, or take 20% of that number and up it by that.
Now, people might think, okay, walking, is that really exercise? Do we get significant fitness benefits of upping our step game?
Absolutely. Walking is one of the most underutilized forms of exercise. It can be done anywhere. It is limited equipment. You basically need a pair of shoes, if even, and some space outside to get walking. And not only are there so many benefits, for longevity, so many health benefits, but really the mental benefits are profound as well for walking.
Does our step target change as we age? Should younger people be getting more steps than somebody, say, over 60?
According to the CDC, that step count does not change with age. The CDC recommends 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity exercise for adults as well as older adults, or 75 minutes of vigorous activity such as jogging, running, hiking. The one thing that does change as we become 65 plus years old is we want to incorporate more balancing activities. So stretching, trying to do some balancing activities such as standing on one leg, that will really help to prevent falls as we age.
Now, some people are, you know, always at the gym or always out jogging, things like that. More power to them. For the rest of us who are maybe working sedentary jobs and not getting a lot of exercise, can you give us a little encouragement, a pep talk to, you know, maybe not run an ultra marathon, but get a little more activity in our lives?
Absolutely. It does not need to be a lot. Getting up one time per day to walk, let's say, to the bathroom or walk to get water is wonderful. So I try to tell people to aim for getting up once per hour just to walk around. If you can take a few 10-minute walking breaks throughout the day, fantastic. If you are out and about, if you can park further away, that is always great. Taking the stairs over the elevator, taking the long way through your office building, whatever it might be, those steps add up. So if you're at home at a sedentary desk job, just getting up once per hour and trying to move throughout the day is a great goal to reach.
Now, walking isn't an option for everyone or easy for everyone. What kind of things are out there to help people with, I guess, adaptive solutions to fitness if, you know, walking is easier said than done?
That really depends on what that person can do. So any type of movement is great. If somebody can bike, if someone can walk, fantastic, but it does, as long as somebody is moving, and it doesn't necessarily mean getting up and going for a walk. If someone has, let's just say, back pain and walking is really difficult or painful for them, just getting up and doing a task around the house can really be beneficial in getting their blood flowing, stretching a little bit. Stretching is a fantastic exercise as well, or doing some Pilates or yoga. As long as you're moving throughout your day, that's what counts.
Shayna Schertz is with us, wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System. We're talking to her about daily fitness step counts on our fitness trackers, how many steps, how much activity we need over the course of a day. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Especially interested to hear if you've found a way to get a little more activity into your day. What is it that motivated you? How did you figure out to make it part of your routine? Is it walking? Was it step counting? Or is it something else? And if you are a step counter, how much do you try to average per day? How have you made sure you hit that amount? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Shayna Schertz, a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health System, and we're talking about fitness, exercise, and counting steps, and why 10,000 steps isn't really a magic number, certainly not for everybody. Hoping to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you go from being mostly sedentary to active, or at least a little less sedentary? How did you figure out how to get fitness into your daily routine? What do you do? Do you track your steps? Do you try to keep a streak going? Do you compete with friends, family members, co-workers? What is it that nudged you into getting more active in your life? Whatever that activity may be, walking, sports, gym, swimming, you name it, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Shayna, it's kind of a cliche that some of us maybe with a new year might say, this is the year I'm going to get fit and I'll get the gym membership, and we don't build it into a routine and it falls by the wayside. What's your advice for people to build at least some kind of activity as part of their routine?
Yeah, first of all, any time of the year is a great time to start a new goal or to set a goal. And so if you are setting a goal, you really want to choose a goal that is going to be attainable and you want to be consistent with it. So if that is, you want to set a goal of increasing your steps by 20%, fantastic. Now, do you want to do that every single day of the week? Do you want to just do that a few days of the week? You really want to start small and build on that, because if we fail and by setting our goal too high, we probably will just give up on that goal. So by setting it small and being consistent with that goal, we typically will reach it, and then we can add more to it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Norm is with us on the road in northwestern Wisconsin. Hi, Norm.
Hey there. How's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, got a question. I want to see if there's any kind of conversion factors, just to sort of ballpark things, because when I'm riding my bicycle, which I do often, and I'm just an average rider, not real fast, not real slow, but I like to go for some distance, and I'll do 50, 60 miles or so. And then my fitness app tells me I need to do more steps because I haven't got enough steps for the day. And I'm saying, oh, my God. So is there anything like a conversion factor?
Well, hang on, Norm. Are you saying 50, 60 miles in one day?
Yes.
Oh, I think you're good, man.
I think so, too, but I just, you know, it says, you know, I haven't done my 10,000 steps, so I should, you know, hang my head in shame.
Norm, thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Shayna, do we have, I think 50, 60 miles a day, you're going to be good no matter what your fitness tracker tells you. But is there a sense of like, okay, this much bike riding compares to this much walking?
We've really gotten into a groove on saying, well, if my fitness activity tracker doesn't state it, it's not true, or right? So if we forget to put it on in the morning and we walk 5 miles, well, that walk never occurred, right? No. So fantastic that biking 50 or 60 miles is fantastic. For walking, typically a mile equals 2,000 steps. So it might be similar with biking. So if you are looking at 10,000, if you are someone that does get 10,000 steps per day, you probably are walking about 5 miles per day.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for the call. And yeah, keep it going. That's fantastic. Let's go now to Amy in Madison. Amy, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about? What do you do for a little bit of fitness?
This is actually perfect timing because I love walking in general. I always have, but when COVID hit, I have issues with anxiety. And when COVID hit, I said, I've got to move. Well, where am I going to go? I can't go anywhere because we're all on lockdown. So I found a place where I could just walk around the place all day. I started counting my steps. And what I realized was I don't worry about the steps. I worry about the fact that I feel good. I try to make my body be the gauge because I don't want to fall into that trap of stressing about how many steps I put in. So my marker that I keep is 6,000 steps, and then I beat it every day, and I feel so good about myself.
Yeah, and Amy, I got to ask, and I've had this happen to me. Do you have those situations where you're feeling a little stressed out, a little anxious, and then you walk, and after a while, you're like, hey, wait, where'd that stress go?
Yeah, but it's not just walking. Actually, my therapist, who I love dearly, said you need to move it out. Whenever you're feeling stressed or depressed or something, move. Just move. And whether it's just dancing or whether it's I have a pedal now, a recumbent pedaler, that I sit down and watch a movie or something, and the whole time I'm getting steps in. There are a million ways. I lost my COVID weight, but more importantly, I feel wonderful. I'm 67. I'm in the best shape of my life. And I would tell anybody, just get off the couch, honey. Just, you can do it.
Amy, thanks so much. Very inspiring. Thanks for sharing that. Shana, I want to key in on what Amy said about the emotional and mental health benefits of walking and other physical activity. What do we know about that?
Absolutely. Walking or exercise in general has so many mental benefits, such as improved mood, decreasing stress. So not only is it good for our heart, it is good for our bodies, our strength. It is really good for to improve our mood. And anyone that does get up and move regularly can probably really notice that improvement in their mood when they are more active.
Amy, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Talking about the benefits of daily fitness and counting our steps with Shana Schertz with Gunderson Health System, wellness education specialist there. Let's bring on another caller now. Tim is with us in Rome. Tim, how are you getting some activity going?
Well, I joined or got a job at Sand Valley Golf Course as a greenskeeper, so one of my coworkers has a Fitbit, and we're getting between 15 and 20,000 steps in about 6 hours. So it's a lot of steps. And I got to say, Amy is absolutely right. The previous caller is, I really don't count my steps. She has a Fitbit. I know what I'm doing. I'm doing the same thing she is. But just feeling better, I'm, you know, feel really good, and I want to get to work. I think that's dopamine that's happening in my head. And so, yeah, I would say go out and get a job as a greenskeeper, and you'll get all kinds of steps in and other little physical work too. And I've lost weight there too. I'm not really counting the weight loss, but I feel good. I know I'm losing weight. My pants are fitting better. I mean, it's all good.
And Tim, can I ask where you are in life? Is this, you know, you're in your 30s, you got a job at the golf course, or is this a post-retirement gig?
It's post-retirement. I'm 64. Yeah, I used to play a lot of racquetball for 40 years, and I got away from that just because a little harder on the joints, and so I just stepped away from that. And doing this instead. So,
Do you golf at all yourself, Tim?
Well, I'm getting to that. I do golf, but
You know, I just started a month and a half ago, so the body's still adjusting. And by the end of my work shift, I'm kind of tired.
Fair enough.
I haven't developed quite yet. We're getting there.
Awesome, Tim. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Shana, Tim brings up a point, you know, the appropriate exercise for us might change over time. That racquetball that was fine in our 20s might be tough on our joints in our 60s.
Correct. We might feel it a little bit more as we age. That's why warming up is so important and sticking with an activity that you enjoy. Not only we might not feel as good when we're doing that activity, we just might fall out of love with that activity. So choosing an activity that we really enjoy and that we can stick with is really important. And Tim brought up another great point of being outside. Anytime we can take our activity outside, that's even an extra benefit. Just simply being out in nature can have an extra mood boost that goes along with the being active.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Shana, if you don't mind me asking, you know, you're in this line of work. Do you wear a fitness tracker yourself and count your own steps?
I do. I wear something called an Aura ring. So it's not on my wrist. It is on my finger. And I do keep track of my steps. Yes.
I do too. Shana, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Shana Schertz is a wellness education specialist at Gunderson Health Systems. She talked to us today about daily step recommendations and what kind of exercise can help keep us fit. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are a lot of questions about nutrition and our health, and it can be tough to study the links between a particular food and health outcomes. So, what about ice cream? Find out what research shows us about the frozen treat and our well-being and what that tells us about nutrition research in general. And homelessness is a problem facing people in communities around the country, and there have been punitive, sometimes violent responses to the presence of homeless people. We'll talk about the way that we talk about homelessness. As always, you can join those conversations and more. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, private equity companies have taken over retail chains, rental houses, medical offices, nursing homes, and more. They've stayed out of the limelight, but they've had a big impact on jobs, pensions, housing costs, and more. Find out more with the author of the new book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out what's happened since the end last week of the immigration restrictions known as Title 42 and how new immigration policies are changing the conditions on the U.S. border with Mexico. First, you may not have heard much about private equity companies, names like Blackstone, Carlyle, and KKR, but there's a good chance they've had an impact on your life. Private equity has taken over businesses in retail, nursing homes, car rentals, healthcare, veterinary care, housing, the list goes on. And our next guest says they mostly change things for the worse. In his new book, he's spreading the word that massive, lucrative, often predatory, and relatively unknown financial firms are dramatically transforming our entire economy, our entire country. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you know about the private equity industry? Have you encountered it in one way or another? What do you want to know? Did you work at Shopko or Toys R Us before they closed down? They're big parts of this story. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brendan Ballou is a federal prosecutor and served as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's antitrust division. In his book, and here on the air, he is not speaking on behalf of the Justice Department. His new book is called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. Brendan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, private equity, not necessarily a household phrase. Big picture, what is it?
So private equity is a term that maybe you've heard of, but if I think we're honest, many of us didn't actually know what it meant. And I have to confess, I didn't know really what it was until I started this project. The basic idea is very simple. Private equity firms use a little bit of their own money, some investor money, and a whole lot of borrowed money to buy up companies. They then make various financial and operational changes to those companies with the aim of selling them for a profit a few years later. It's a pretty simple idea, but for reasons that we can discuss, it often leads to bad outcomes for companies, for customers, and for employees.
Right. I can hear a good version of this story where, okay, this big company, it's struggling, poorly managed maybe. Here comes the private equity company, buys it, makes it more efficient, healthier, sells it off, everybody wins. The case you're making in your book is that is not usually what actually happens.
Yeah, and I don't want to overstate my case. There are many private equity deals that, you know, turn out successfully for, you know, not just investors, but for the companies themselves. But there are some basic problems with the private equity business model that lead to bad consequences very often. Very quickly, they are private equity firms tend to buy and hold the companies for just a few years, so they have a very short-term focus. They tend to load up the companies they buy with a lot of debt and extract a lot of fees. And most importantly, and this is the part that interests me as a lawyer, and again, I thank you for caveating that I'm speaking in a personal capacity and not necessarily that the opinion of the Justice Department. What's really interesting is they're very good at insulating themselves from liability for actions that they take or that their portfolio companies take. So when you have that combination of short-term focus, a lot of debt and fees, and limited legal liability, it often leads to bad results.
Can you talk us through the scope of private equity? I gave a few examples of industries, but how widespread are these kind of companies and the companies that they end up buying?
Private equity surrounds you. PE firms spent over $1 trillion buying companies last year. And just for a sense of scale, the entire U.S. GDP was about $25 trillion last year. You already touched on some examples, but if you go to a veterinary clinic or an OBGYN practice, if you buy clothes, pet food, or contact lenses, in some cities, the very water that you drink is provided by a private equity firm. I always joke that if you read my book, the private equity is literally right in front of you because the font that we use is owned and licensed by a private equity-owned portfolio company.
Let's look at a particular case with a lot of relevance here in Wisconsin. The business Shopko, now out of business. There's a spinoff eye care firm called Shopko Optical, but it's pretty much gone. And the examples you give in the story of Shopko are pretty common in a lot of these private equity buyouts, starting with some of the decisions made soon after a company gets bought. Can you talk us through Shopko and how it represents the wider story?
Absolutely. And Shopko is near and dear to my heart as a place that I, you know, went to a lot in southern Minnesota and Wisconsin growing up. Shopko was bought by the private equity firm Sun Capital in 2006 or 2007. And then Sun Capital executed a number of tactics that are pretty common within the industry. For one thing, they executed what's called a sale leaseback, where they required Shopko to sell all of the real estate of the stores that they own and lease those stores back. That's a tactic that gave Shopko and its private equity owner a quick hit of cash, but now it meant that Shopko had to essentially indefinitely pay for something that it used to own. Sun Capital then executed a bunch of transaction fees and management fees, essentially fees that Shopko had to pay for the privilege of being owned by Sun Capital, as well as, I believe, executing what's called a dividend recapitalization, where essentially Shopko had to borrow money to pay Sun Capital and its other investors. All these tactics were tremendously successful for Sun Capital, the private equity owner. But as you know, and many of your listeners do, it ultimately pushed Shopko itself into bankruptcy, and it essentially no longer exists as a business.
Talking to Brendan Ballou about his new book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Maybe your experiences if you worked for Shopko or Toys R Us or another business that's no longer in business after being purchased by a private equity company. Join in at 800-642-1234. Brendan, one thing that always baffles me in some of these private equity deals is, okay, I'm a private equity company. I'm buying company X over here. Some of the money I'm using to buy it ends up as a loan held by that company I just bought. So me buying it saddled that company with a lot of debt. How does that work? How does it impact the company?
It's a great question. And it's a sort of financial magic trick that private equity firms are able to do. So as I mentioned at the outset, and as you alluded to in your question, when private equity firms buy up companies, they use a lot of debt. But the really interesting thing is it's debt that the acquired company, not the private equity firm, typically holds. So in the case of when Carlyle buys the nursing home chain HCR Manor Care, which you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with, it did so for about $6 billion. Most of that was money that Manor Care had to hold on to rather than Carlyle. And as a result, Manor Care spent a lot of money just paying the cost of servicing the debt, which makes it harder for it to invest in facilities, invest in staff, and so forth.
Let's talk about what this means for different groups of people. First of all, employees. In case after case you give after a company is bought in this way, often they're sort of pension washed. Pensions that people may have counted on after working for a company for a long time disappear or go to another service. What happens?
So it's a really fascinating story. I'll give a quick example of when actually the same private equity firm, Sun Capital, bought up the diner chain Friendly's, which, you know, serve classic hamburgers and milkshakes and so forth. Friendly executed a lot of the same tactics that we were talking about sale leasebacks and so forth, and ultimately pushed Friendly's into bankruptcy. But Sun Capital wasn't just Friendly's owner. It was also Friendly's largest lender. And by doing that, in a bankruptcy process, normally the lenders sort of get control of the company. Sun Capital was able to sell Friendly's from itself to itself. And the reason that it did that is by doing so in the bankruptcy process, Friendly's was able to push off the pension obligation that Friendly's owned onto what's called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a quasi-government agency that insures pensions. And so the result of that was that Sun Capital was allowed to keep a business that it had bankrupted, but it was able to lose the pension obligations that Friendly's employees and retirees depended on.
Then impact on consumers. And I want to focus in on one particular industry, care facilities. The senior care facilities sometimes end up in the hands of these private equity companies. And you write about reports of declines in care over time. What happens?
So I alluded to this in answering one of your earlier questions. Carlyle bought up the nursing home chain Manor Care and loaded up with debt, executed sale leasebacks. Ultimately, health code violations spiked and at least one resident died. The interesting thing is when the resident's family sued for wrongful death, Carlyle was able to get the case against it dismissed, essentially by saying that it wasn't the technical owner of the nursing home chain. Instead, it merely advised a series of funds whose limited partners through several shell companies ultimately owned the nursing home chain. And that was enough to get the case against Carlyle dismissed. And I think it illustrates that point we were making, that oftentimes private equity firms insulate themselves from liability or for the consequences of their actions. And just to put a pin on that, there's been some really interesting research because nursing homes are incredibly popular for private equity firms to buy. At least by one estimate, private equity firm ownership of nursing homes is responsible for over 20,000 premature deaths over a 15-year period.
We're talking to Brendan Ballou about his new book. It's called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, with your experience. If you worked at a place or were a customer of a business that you relied on that was taken over by a private equity company, did it go well or poorly for you? Is your landlord one of these private equity companies? We'll get to your calls and some suggested changes that our guest has in mind. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about private equity companies with Brendan Ballou. He's a federal prosecutor. His new book is called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us now in Slinger. Mike, hi.
Hi, Rob. I'm familiar with the veterinary clinics. I heard that on public radio. A lot of small towns, they buy them up and then they run a bankrupt and then there's no vet left in the town. But my comment is that I think about 6 months ago, Kohl's went through this very thing with some
private equity firm trying to buy them out. And somehow they fought them off. They wanted to put someone on the board, the equity company did, and they fought them off. But I remember them saying specifically that they wanted to rent the stores back to Kohl's. And your guest just mentioned that before, that's what happened to Shopko, and they just drain them. So I just thought I'd make that as a comment.
Mike, thanks for that call. Yeah, I see WPR reported on that that very thing you're talking about, Mike. Thanks for sharing that. I want to mention Mike's other comment, Brendan, about veterinary clinics. I wouldn't think that would be a huge investment opportunity, but what is happening in that field, Brendan?
It's really interesting. Private equity is really attracted to veterinary clinics. And in fact, I think the largest veterinary chains in America are all owned by private equity firms now. I think veterinary clinics present a couple of opportunities for PE firms. One is, you know, sort of during and after quarantine, pet ownership and spending on pets really rose dramatically. So they see it as a growth industry. It's also a fairly dispersed industry right now. And so I think private equity firms see it as a way to potentially roll up different businesses and combine them under one umbrella. That potentially has sort of benefits of scale, but it also potentially could raise prices for consumers or cut salaries for veterinarians and lab technicians. And in fact, the FTC just recently enjoined a recent private equity acquisition of a veterinary chain. So it's something clearly that PE is interested in.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mike joins us now in Marshall. Mike, hello.
Excuse me. I'm just cleaning up from No Mo Me.
I feel anyway, you, man.
Yeah, I worked for Shopko, and I could almost believe that there was a layer of ripoff going before Sun Capital reared its head. But then when they showed up, it was obvious that they were running the place into the ground. There was places being bought, and they'd try and staff them. There wasn't any business, and they were just, you know, there was just some game being played down in Florida, but it didn't really bother me because I was headed to greener pastures.
Mike, thanks for calling and sharing that experience with us. Brendan, yeah, Shopko not in great shape before that buyout by Sun. How does somebody make money, as Mike says, running this business into the ground?
Well, sometimes, you know, it's a genuine effort to turn a company around and see if they can make a profit from it. But oftentimes, or at least sometimes, private equity firms can, you know, make money by essentially selling the business for parts. You know, in a case of Marsh Supermarkets, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, the private equity firm, I think, realized that the assets of the real estate were worth more than the business itself. So they acquired it, sold the real estate, made their money back, and essentially just had a grocery chain to boot, you know, that was just sort of a cherry on top. It all means that, you know, sometimes private equity firms' interests are aligned with the companies they buy, but not always. And that seems to be what happened with Shopko.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Brenda joins us now in Menominee. Brenda, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Brenda?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, why is it that these companies allow themselves to be bought by these private equity firms? Do they have a choice in the matter? What's in it for them?
Good question. Brendan.
Brenda, it's a great question. So sometimes, you know, a private equity firm can be genuinely helpful in sort of injecting capital into a business and so forth. I will say that oftentimes private equity acquisitions, you know, whether they work or not for the acquired company, can be extremely valuable for the executives of the company that's bought. You know, a lot of these executives are compensated in part or primarily in stock or other equity in the business. And so, you know, a buyout is an opportunity for those folks to cash out.
Brenda, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Brendan Ballou about his new book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. Evan joins us next in Viroqua. Evan, hi.
Hi. My question, I don't know if it pertains to this. I don't know if private equity is involved or not. But years ago, Kmart was struggling, and they were going to go through bankruptcy. And then the next thing I heard, they bought Sears, a bigger company than them. So, like, how does that work?
Evan, thanks for the call. Brendan, I don't know if that particular story was private equity, but you write it's very common for a private equity company to merge different companies in the same line of business.
Yeah, it's a great question, Evan. You know, I believe the Kmart story was ultimately would be classified more as a hedge fund. And just to make the distinction clear, you know, hedge funds tend to invest in securities, stocks, bonds, and so forth. Private equity firms tend to buy whole companies. It's not a clear legal distinction, but that's sort of a rough division of labor there. So as you were saying, private equity firms often have a strong interest in mergers and acquisitions. And I already sort of touched on this a little bit when we were talking about veterinary clinics, but a lot of times private equity firms are interested in what are called roll-up opportunities. So these are chances to buy up businesses in a dispersed industry, combine them, and then, you know, potentially get efficiencies of scale, but also, you know, potentially, you know, raise prices or lower wages and things like that. So potentially we're seeing that happen in veterinary clinics, but we're seeing it happen in all sorts of industries. In healthcare, for instance, there's really interesting reporting on private equity firms getting interested in buying up small practices or clinics, OBGYN practices, oncology practices, urgent care, dermatology, and so forth. There's really interesting stories out there about private equity when they private equity firms, after they bought dermatology clinics, were essentially making medical supply decisions on behalf of doctors. And at least according to one story, were buying needles that were so cheap that they would break off in people's arms. Now, that's, yeah, pretty scary stuff. That's certainly not what always happens, but it is a common tactic of private equity firms. So it's a very good point.
Thanks for that call, Evan. I want to take our last few minutes, Brendan, on solutions you offer. You say it might be an uphill battle because the government, Congress, the White House has made it pretty easy to do these things. But you say there's room for some substantial changes. What kind of things would be at the top of your agenda?
So it goes back to the basic problems that we've got with the private equity business model. You know, short-term thinking, a reliance on debt and fees, and insulation from liability. And if you can solve those problems, private equity can be made to be a useful part of our financial system. You know, I always say as long as companies need, you know, to build factories and hire new workers, there needs to be somebody willing to take the bet and make the investment on that. Now, how do we do that? Congress can obviously pass legislation to address some of those flaws. But, you know, we live in a time of a divided Congress. And truthfully, there are a lot of other sort of levers of power where things can happen, whether we're talking about at the federal level, agencies like the Securities and Exchange Commission, Health and Human Services, Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, and so forth can act. But also states and localities can, you know, modify their laws to make it harder to do some of the more extractive tactics that private equity firms do. So all of which is to say that there's a lot that can be, that should be done, and there are a lot of different ways that we could do it. So I think that there is some reason for optimism here.
Now, because these companies, they're huge, but they're not necessarily visible on a daily basis, are you hopeful that everyday people might look at this and advocate for some of the changes you're calling for?
Absolutely. You know, I think that you know, people, whether they perceive it consciously or not, are affected by private equity every day. And there's a lot that ordinary people can do, whether it's, you know, getting involved in a specific organization and just Google private equity and, you know, you'll see some of the names that pop up, to just making your voice heard. I really can't emphasize enough, you know, how much hearing stories about how people are affected can really affect, you know, bureaucrats in Washington like me or, you know, people that are trying to make positive change.
Brendan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Brendan Belew, federal prosecutor who served as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's antitrust division. Again, he's not speaking for the Justice Department in this conversation. We talked with him about his new book. It's called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. If you have a story about an encounter with a private equity in some part of your life, a good or bad, we would love to hear it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Do you work somewhere that has been, or did you work somewhere that has been taken over by a private equity company, or have you rented from them? They own a lot of houses. Have you yourself or a loved one been in a care center owned by one? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the director of the UW Law School Immigrant Justice Clinic about the end of Title 42, a big border restriction that just ended last week, and new immigration rules put in place by the Biden administration. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.